Good afternoon. I'd like to call this meeting in the Senate Transportation Committee to order. The time is 1:35 p.m. We're in Butrovich, room 205, in the nation's most beautiful capital city of Juneau, Alaska. Today is Thursday, March 12th, 2026. Members present are Senator Rauscher, Senator Tobin, and myself, Senator Bjorkman. Senators Keel and Stedman are in the Finance Committee this fine afternoon. Let the record reflect that we do have a quorum to conduct business. Welcome, everyone, to Senate Transportation. Please turn off and silence your cell phones. And join me in welcoming our recording secretary, Heather Ramseth, and our LAO moderator, Doug Bridges. Today, we'll hear two presentations. First, we'll hear a presentation from Hannah Leatherman on using graphene nanopellets as an alternative to road brine. Next, we will have the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities conclude their winter road maintenance presentation that they began on the 27th of January earlier this year. First up, we have the Caring for the Kenai Student Competition Award winner. She won first place, Hannah Leatherman. She's a Seward Seahawk from Seward High School, here to present on her project and her idea to replace the use of road brine on our roads. Ms. Leatherman, thank you so much for joining us today in Senate Transportation. Congratulations once again for winning this very prestigious award. The Caring for the Kenai competition, started by a guy, really fascinating guy named Merrill Sikorsky, has been going on for decades on the Kenai Peninsula. And it really puts out a challenge to young people on the Kenai about how they can improve our way of life, how they can improve the community around them. And Hannah, in a very long and prestigious tradition of winners to that project, has come up with a great idea. So I'm excited that you're here. Welcome. Could you please state your name for the record and begin your presentation?
My name is Hannah Leatherman, and I'll begin now. Good evening, everyone. Today, I would like to propose an idea to you that will not only save thousands of lives in the state of Alaska, but my idea will be covering the dangers of black ice and how we can prevent its formation. Black ice is a type of glazed ice. It forms in freezing temperatures below 32 degrees when pavement is wet. This invisible killer causes 2,000 deaths and nearly 135,000 accidents annually on average in the U.S. The ice itself is a clear, invisible glaze, with the asphalt giving off the illusion of the ice being black, hence the name. The current solution that we're using to prevent black ice is a mixture of water and 23.3% sodium chloride. It's a salt brine mixture that the Department of Transportation uses on our roads. While doing my research, I found that the salt brine solution is not only polluting and destroying our ecosystems, but is also the cause of many other issues in our environment, including the following. It attracts wildlife and increases collision risks. It's toxic to animals, contaminates water, increases soil erosion, creates rust buildup on important safety features like brakes and airbags, and causes potholes. And the photos I have shown is a photo of a moose licking off the salt brine off of someone's vehicle, and the other one is actually the underside of my dad's truck. The consequences of the salt brine solution are actually more detrimental than the black ice itself. We need to consider on how we can improve on our choices to minimize damages going further. My solution to this issue is an asphalt mix that's less susceptible to ice formation. Now, there are definitely different ways we could go about solving this issue, but I found the best idea would be to use a material called graphene nanoplatelets. Graphene nanoplatelets are graphene sheets in hexagonal lattice structure. Its characteristics would be a game changer to preventing ice formation, with its key characteristics including lightweight mechanical properties, great thermal and electrical conductivity, together with low cost and easy manufacturing. I came up with three steps to executing my plan, starting off with number one, creating this modified asphalt mix. Now, I'm no scientist yet, but I have done my research, and the only reason I could find for why we haven't used this material is because it's new technology. But from my research, I found that graphene-enhanced asphalt has been successfully tested on a public road in Teesside, Northeast England, promising us a new future for our roads. My next step would be to hopefully... Sorry. My next step would be to hopefully implement this new mix onto our roads. Now, I'm not saying we go out and we rip out all of our perfectly undamaged asphalt, but I think the best idea would be to replace the roads with this new mix when it needs the repairing instead. Additionally, we should be utilizing nanoplatelets in the new roads we are constructing. Step 3 would be to hopefully expand the use of this mix worldwide. This superior mix could possibly be a life-changing fix that would benefit not just our community, but everywhere that it is desperately needed as well. The future of our roads lies within the choices we make today, so let's pave the way towards a more economical and sustainable future together. Thank you.
Ms. Leatherman, thank you. Very well done. I see my colleagues have some questions for you. Senator Tobin and then Senator Rauscher.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm curious, when you were researching this really unique and interesting technology, did you come across whether it's manufactured in Alaska or if there are any possible ways of manufacturing it here in Alaska?
So I got in contact with Graphite One, and at the moment they are the largest graphite deposit mine that we have, but they aren't going to be active until 2030. So until then, I'm not completely sure, but I know there are some places, I think in China, they're working on it. And there are a couple other graphite deposits across the states and stuff. So that's the only possible places I could think about where we could.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. And my only comment is I, too, love Graphite One, particularly because I'm from Nome, Alaska. But also for the public record, I do have stock in the company and just want to make sure that's disclosed, that I did not necessarily encourage you to say any of that.
Senator Rauscher.
Well, thank you. Through the chair, I just want to say thank you. But I wanted to know how the process came about. Were you looking for a way to solve a black eyes problem, or did you run across something and you said, hey, this could probably be used to solve a black eyes problem? I was just wondering how you came up with this, because I think it's very intriguing.
Yes, thank you. I when I was doing my research, I first started on looking up what was causing all the moose crashes up on the Kenai Peninsula. We have a sign up there where it says how many moose crashes are caused since July. And I found that that was actually linked to the salt brine that we use on our roads, which led to why we were using it. It was because of the black ice. So that's how I came to start about my project.
And then finding the answer?
Yes. So I did a lot of research, and at first I was researching things about how people use beets and potatoes to melt ice off of their cars, and then I started moving on to more molecular properties and found that graphene nanoplatelets were in production in certain countries and continents. So that's how I came to be about that.
And what grade are you in?
I'm a sophomore.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Hannah, well done. I'm wondering about what are the processes that cause the asphalt made with the graphene nanoplatelets to not form ice? Can you talk about the mechanism a little bit? How does that work?
I don't know very much about it, but all I do know is that the properties of the graphene nanoplatelets can both heat the asphalt during the winter, and I heard that they can also cool the asphalt in the summer. I don't know all the science behind it, but that's all that I have researched. Thank you.
Okay. Very good. Excellent. Yeah, I am excited to learn more, and we have lots of folks who pay attention to this committee that are way into the chemistry and makeup and all the engineering that goes into laying down an asphalt mat. And I hope they find this topic interesting and are willing to research further. So thank you once again.
Thank you.
Are there any closing comments or remarks that you'd like to share with the committee?
Nothing, but thank you for having me here. It's a really amazing opportunity, and I'm super excited to be here.
You're very welcome. And I know some of your schoolmates there are going to go to the state basketball tournament. Is that correct?
I think so.
Yeah, so we're paying attention to them as well, but we're glad you're here with us.
Yes,
this is a pretty neat experience that you get to do. That is pretty unique, so I'm thankful for that.
Thank you.
All right, we'll take a brief at ease while we set up for the next presentation. We're back on the record now. It's 1:48 p.m. here in Senate Transportation. Next up, we are going to continue the presentation from the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities on winter road maintenance that we began hearing in January. From the department, we have Andy Mills, as well as Marcus Zimmerman, and Dan Adamczak, as well as Christine Langley. Both of those folks are online, available for comments and questions as well. Gentlemen, welcome to Senate Transportation. We are very glad that you're here. Could you please put yourselves on the record and resume your presentation?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Andy Mills, Special Assistant and Legislative Liaison for the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Marcus Zimmerman, Chief of Maintenance and Operations for South Coast Region, Department of Transportation and Public Facilities.
And again, for the record, Andy Mills. Mr. Chairman, wanted to start this, if you would be okay, making sure I state on the previous presenter, just to give some context from the department on graphene nanoplatelet.
Yes, that would be most excellent.
That was a suggestion I'm happy to provide at least a little more context to. So when we did hear of that story and received from your office the article on that effort, this is the kind of fun stuff that we obviously look forward to engagement. Quite often the department, it's naming contests or in some cases the next ferry named after a glacier. Those are the kind of fun things that, while rare, are certainly fun for us. On that particular contest, we did forward it on to our chief engineer, who does oversee materials and specifications for projects. And I did recently touch base with her again when we found out this presentation would be in this committee. And just wanted you to know, we have looked into what that might entail. There is not a large body of research on this subject for us to draw from. We did find the reference, I believe, to the Chinese study that did had Chinese researchers on this subject. And then we also found our DMIO office did identify a Russian study as well. And so while there is some information, we haven't found anything that would be considered for like a meta-analysis or an America-specific analysis. So we certainly would want to engage a bit more deeply on the subject to look into it. I know cost is one of the things I haven't heard so far, and that is one of the pieces in this one. When I took my handy dandy friend ChatGPT, which we should not rely on solely, but just to get some sense, it did say that a 3% mixture, which was suggested in the Russian literature, could be the percentage that you would put in asphalt. It started to give with an M millions behind what you would need. But again, that's highly, highly dependent on where you would procure it from and what amounts. So I think it's far too soon to put a dollar figure. You'd want to sort of get to the efficacy of it first and test it out. So to that end, I did offer the family my business card so that they could get a hold of us. And we do want to offer their assistance in scoping out a research request that we can put forward as part of our research program. And I've talked to our DMIO folks, and they're absolutely open to that.
Awesome.
And we're looking for nominations right now for research. And there's a couple different programs that could fit. But certainly following up on that, to temper expectations, that can take 1 to 2 years for rapid research or 3 to 5 for typical research. So just – but, however, all journeys start with that first step, right? So,
very good. Thank you. Senator Rauscher.
So, thank you. Through the chair. So, I'm wondering, since you brought this up, and she did mention 2 or 3 different ways that we are combating ice now, and have you done a study at all on, not salt and brine, but the other, on how it may be affecting wildlife as far as animals go? She did bring that up. And so I'm wondering, has the DOT done a study on whether or not it's actually affecting wildlife in a negative way?
So through the chair to Senator Rauscher, it's a very good question. I know nationally there are a lot of states who have these interests, have the question as to what effect that would have, to what extent, right? Anytime you put anything from the roadway off, and by the way, that would include other materials, which I have heard of. There's 6 PD, something from tires that the tire industry proactively told us is an aging off of the tires, produces some sort of chemical that can wash off. And so there's a stormwater collection and biofiltration piece of that. There's numerous areas where this conversation could come in about what are the impacts of certain things on roadways and how to mitigate against those from the environmental and biological. I don't know currently of a lot of literature. I know that the advocates for the Kenai Peninsula area did point out a study from Washington about, and I think it was related to salt in general, getting down into anadromous streams and fish populations. But I have also suggested for those brine advocates to reach out to Fish and Game and some of the others if they wanted Alaska-specific studies to be initiated to get better information on that. I might ask if Mr. Zimmerman might have more from the Clear Roads standpoint. First, he can explain what Clear Roads is, so you get why I'm referencing that, and then anything from that perspective.
Again, for the record, Marcus Zimmerman, South Coast Region, Department of Transportation, Public Facilities. So Clear Roads is a national organization. It's a pool fund. So what that means is that many states pool money together to do research projects. Clear Roads has done many research projects around chlorides, salt in the environment and things like that. They just recently completed a study on how chlorides move through different soil types. So there's lots of information out there on the topics that we would have to, you know, dive into specific details on that I don't obviously have today. But that is a great resource when it comes to looking at different winter maintenance techniques and uses for different de-icing agents that are out there, not only salt, but other ones that are available as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know we've talked about this before, but it does sound like it would be intriguing to delve into kind of the technology of road construction. There has been many advents over the years. I know at one point some of the asphalt mixes were including some of our recycled glass at one period of time or another, that we've also talked about some of the ways that we construct our roads to get to the clear road dynamic. Not that I necessarily enjoy the deep technical conversations, as sometimes they're over my head, but it might be very interesting for the public, and also I think I'd learn a lot.
Through the chair to Senator Vice Chair Tobin. So on that subject, we do have a, I call it pavement science for shorthand, but we do have an upcoming presentation, which we are scheduling with this committee to go through both how the pavement sort of application process or paving process works, given some of the conversations that we have had. And then also we're tying into that conversation asset management, because really from a federal perspective, they want to know what specifications and what processes are you doing to ensure that the federal dollars spent on our infrastructure last? And to what extent are you maintaining and caring for that so that, that dollar goes as far as it can for the public? So it's a great conversation we'll look forward to. I will also personally say there are a number of other areas. House Transportation previously had the chair, Grier Hopkins. Shout out to Fairbanks. That was a really fun – he was a great chair. It was fun. And he, at the time, I believe, was also considering or had bills associated with industrial hemp, which is a fascinating substance in its strength and the ability to grow that. And so you have an agricultural component. And I personally would like to see some more research around industrial hemp as a fiber in some applications. It probably is not right for everything. And again, it's a cost consideration. But yet you can get sort of, especially in earthquake-prone areas, some sort of shear force that might be gained by basically a fiberglass application, because that's what industrial hemp effectively is. But of course, you need contractors that can do that to specification. You need those to be signed off by the federal government. So typically that requires a long period of time to do R&D in a small area. And the one I would mention now is we had a great test project in Anchorage using a harder aggregate, but it was more expensive. And that was to say, is buying a more expensive aggregate worth the lifespan gain you get from that infrastructure? We're paving it less, so it's better for the public. We're not going back as frequently. But is that upfront cost net positive over the long term? So there's really interesting background we can get into and get into that specifically.
Great.
Yes, I'm looking forward to that presentation a lot.
So, Mr. Chairman, to continue this, unless there's any other questions, we're starting on slide 19, which is effectively where we left off. We transitioned to our northern region. I'll save Mr. Adam Zach, who's on the phone, as he starts the piece that obviously this material was generated in January of the year. So much of this will be verbally updated as we're going along in each slide. To the extent that we have those updates, if there's anything that you would want specifically, we can always provide it later in writing. But with that, I might turn it over to Mr. Adams to lead us through the Northern Region slides.
Thank you. For the record, Daniel Adams, Northern Region Maintenance and Operations Engineer. We'll start with the slide. As Andy mentioned, a number of these statistics have been changed a little bit as we've gone over a month since this slide deck was put together. The total number of events as of late January is 151. Fairbanks has had a particularly snowy February, so this number has increased substantially. We had the second snowiest February on record in Fairbanks with just under 40 inches of new snow. That number changed a little bit depending on where in Fairbanks you were, but that should speak to the kind of active and always evolving nature of maintenance and operations work. The percentage time target condition achieved, while we don't know what that is, we're currently reaching out and collecting that data, and we should be able to have it soon. We don't have it yet for this presentation. One of the things with that immense amount of snow, moving kind of onto the second part of this slide, is it does affect sidewalk recovery with limited right-of-way on a lot of our roads. With heavy snowfall, the intermediate snow storage is the side of the road, which happens to be the sidewalk. So as we recover from these storms, we work on hauling snow to snow dumps. We use contractors to help us clear those sidewalks as well as haul off snow. It's an ongoing process. But we still, despite that snow, have maintained significantly below average temperatures. When I woke up this morning, for anecdotal evidence, it was about 40 below. Our typical low for this time of year is just below zero. So it's pretty chilly here and has been for a while. Next slide, please.
Before we go,
I
have a question. My question is maybe in regard to state facilities, but it also I think would apply very well to municipalities around the state and how they kind of plan for rights of way, sidewalks, and the potential of boulevards. I grew up in Upper Michigan where we got significant amounts of snow, well over 150 inches most years, sometimes about 300 inches or more. Many, many communities in that snow country have substantial boulevards along many streets between the road and the sidewalks. Sometimes a boulevard would be 4 feet, sometimes it would be up to 10 feet, and specifically designed as part of a yard many times or other landscape feature that is capable of snow storage. As we think about a warmer climate that is going to produce more snow in many parts of our state, is there any conversations at all about designing facilities that have boulevards or more snow storage capabilities without creating huge massive ditches that people just fill with wood and other material?
Yeah, so to the chair, we have that conversation when projects are in design almost every time maintenance is brought in. We work closely with our peers in design to talk about winter snow removal. A lot of times the right-of-way for these projects has been in place since statehood a while ago. And as areas develop and the need for additional lanes to handle traffic comes about, that slowly squeezes our ability to create additional snow storage. And so despite the fact that it is a conversation, sometimes we are limited by the land that belongs to the state. Other businesses, homes, residential areas that are built up alongside those roads we have to be cognizant of their property and work within the limits of our right of way.
Absolutely. Yep. That all sounds good. But as if Madam Vice Chair were to have a magic wand and create all of the lane diets possible, I think maybe we could have additional capacity for boulevards and snow storage with lane reductions. Maybe. I don't know.
Mr. Chairman, I only need one road to ride my bike on.
Thank you. Please continue.
Next slide, please.
Is that the left lane of Sixth Avenue?
Please continue.
Absolutely. So the winter contract usage is ongoing. We started it in fiscal year 23 with total expenditures of just under $260,000. As you can see, it varies our use year by year, highly weather dependent. Most of our winter contract usage goes to priority 3 and 4 roads. That's kind of how it started, is response to those sometimes outlying roads or less used roads, depending on weather. So this year, as of the writing of this slide, we used the overall contracts 10 times. You can see the breakdown there with 4 times on roads, 5 times on sidewalks, and 1 in Cordova. We are now, based on the February storms, up to 18 uses, and we are right about $330,000 in use this year. So a substantial increase, in large part due to record snow. So that'll give perspective on our ability to respond and scale accordingly based on need.
Thank you for that, Mr. Adamczyk. I'm curious, as we talk about, and we could talk about this with other regions as well, priority 3 and 4 roads with winter maintenance. Some user groups would prefer to be able to use those priority roads and have them groomed as ski trails, dog sled trails, not motorized use. And some communities have adapted state roads for this purpose, and then they try to control access to those state roads to suit their preferred purpose. Is this something that happens in your region? Is there anything that we can do to help kind of mitigate these user conflicts?
So we do have roads that are closed in the wintertime, and those may be for Northern Region, my experience, I can't comment on South Coast or Central Region, but those sometimes are groomed for use by various recreational users. I can't comment. I can get back to you on whether we have Northern Region ones that are priority 3 or 4s that are have been approached for uses recreational.
Mr. Chairman, Andy Mills for the record. Typically, the priority 3s and 4s are local roads and not usually closed in the winter. It's priority 5 that is considered closed with the red line. And in many, like Hatcher's Pass is, I think, a fairly good example. There's an area up there that's closed, and that's an example of a road that is closed and highly used for recreational access in the wintertime. And I mean, my understanding is that I don't know that we would ever want to restrict access. If it's public funding for a road, we can certainly close it from a dangerous like maintenance and not wanting any cars to get in danger. But from a recreational standpoint, that's still a public use road. And so I don't know that we would seek to restrict access by Nordic skiers or a lot of other user groups. And they typically do want us to keep that access available to them, of course.
Okay. Yep. Maybe we'll talk about that when we talk about other regions as well. Okay. Please continue.
All right. For the record, Daniel Adamczyk. Next slide, please.
You got it.
So this, again, is a snapshot and is active and evolving. One thing you can see, kind of the vacancy rate as of about a year ago compared to just this past January, While some of them are staying fairly similar, I would like to draw your attention to kind of a success in the Dalton District. We've had success in attracting and filling a number of vacancies in the district. We believe that part of this is due to a flexible two-on, two-off schedule. There's a little bit of a pay incentive just byproduct of the hours worked under that two-on, two-off. That also provides the department with some flexibility. As people are on their 2 weeks off, we can call them in, bring them in for needed storm work or other things that come up. And so that's been a beneficial to both the department, and we've seen it attracting a number of new crew members. Valdez and Western districts still struggle to attract and fill vacancies out there. One thing I would like to draw your attention to is this shows eight vacancies kind of both years in Valdez. Valdez is the district. Cordova itself has five or six of those vacancies, and so that's a much more extreme when you break it down by individual camp. Valdez and Western are also both airport-heavy districts, and so airport operators are typically required to be trained in a lot of different things, including airport rescue and firefighting, security, some other tasks that come with running Part 139 airports at remote locations. And so finding qualified individuals for those positions is also a little bit of a taller order.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In a recent Senate Education Committee, we talked a lot about CTE programs in schools and working to kind of grow our own and our workforce development. Has there been conversations with the maintenance districts and with the Department of Transportation on how you might be able to focus in some of our excellent programming in our education system to hopefully fill some of these positions through a pipeline?
Through the chair to Senator Tobin, there has been a lot of work on DOT to utilize CDL training programs. And so we've actually partnered and used funding to work with interested parties to bring them on, pay them, send them to CDL training, basically bring them in at a ground level and then train them up to be familiar with equipment operation and into progressively more advanced roles within the department. We have seen some success with that, and it's helped to overcome some of the vacancies, and we look forward to continuing that program and seeing what we can do to potentially move them on up into some of the more harder to fill roles at some of the airports as well.
Hello?
Yes.
I know that one of the great programs, Mr. Chairman, that we have in our schools is called Educator Rising, and it would be very fun to see a similar program such as DOT Rising with our K-12 system, particularly in our high school, as I know that there are some considerations that kids need to have when it comes to drug testing and all sorts of other types of commitments on their best behavior so they don't engage in the juvenile justice system. As they think about these career options. So it'd be interesting to work with you on what some of those CTE programs might be able to be developed to look like.
Senator Rauscher also has a question.
Yeah, real quick. So I'm just looking at your chart right now. I'm looking at Valdez, and I know we explained earlier that five or six of those actually belong to the Cordova area, but that leaves two or three. And I was just wondering, where does the Valdez area extend to? Does it go all the way to Glen Allen? Because I don't really see that mentioned here. So I'm just trying to get a better picture of what we do not or what we are not able to do in the Valdez area.
Yeah, so the Valdez area actually extends all the way up to Richardson to mile 42, so north of Thompson Pass. And then Ernestine Camp will take over, and that's part of the Teslina district. So about 40 miles north of Valdez is where that area extends to. I'm sorry, through the chair.
So real quick. So the other two to three belong to that are not in Cordova.
Through the chair, I believe those. So as I mentioned, this is kind of an active evolving thing. I believe as of the writing of this, both of them belong to Thompson Pass.
So we'll call that Valdez then. Okay. All right. Yeah. Thank you.
I have a question on this slide as well. And this other regions can answer if they want to on this topic now or later. As we've engaged in the subcommittee process and talked with other departments as well, a recurring theme is that on exit interviews, departments are seeing notice of pay problems being brought up as a reason why people might be leaving. To what extent is that a factor in your experience in the Northern region?
To the chair, I'd have to get back to you on that. I haven't seen a breakdown of the exit interviews myself. I know that we do keep that, and we can take a look at that as a overall percentage of the exit interviews that have been filled out.
Excellent. Yes, I would appreciate that. And as we kind of track the redistribution of payroll employees and jobs from the Department of Administration back into other departments, many of us are wondering if the amount of positions that DOT will get back from the Department of Administration will be sufficient to cover payroll on a day-to-day basis, as well as to deal with the notice of pay problems that currently exist or we may expect to exist in the future. So I think that's a larger conversation that we'll likely have at a future meeting organizationally, but I would be interested to hear anecdotally even if you know of or have a sense of how much you feel pay issues are impacting vacancy rates.
To the chair, I don't even have a good feeling anecdotally. I apologize for that.
No, it's okay. That's okay. So if your hair's not on fire on it, then that's probably good.
And Mr. Chairman, Andy Mills for the record. So I know I've heard from legislative offices who have inquired about issues on operators in particular, and they've run the gamut. I know the example within DOT that this committee is aware of course, is when DOT took on AMHS payroll, yeah. We were able to sort of significantly impact that same conversation. We would look to have the same impact in the rest of the department. And I believe that Director Pannone has testified in other committee hearings that the number of positions as part of this budgetary action to take that back is deemed sufficient for us to accomplish that task. But we'll look forward to doing that on the Senate side as well, because I believe that was in the other body.
So. Very well. Yeah, I think that meeting's coming up next week. Please continue.
All right. For the record, Daniel Adamsack. Next slide, please.
Go ahead.
I think you're there. So some of the Northern Region challenges that we face are extreme cold weather. So this has also been a particularly cold winter in Northern Region, kind of all over, not just Fairbanks. And some of the problems that we see arise during extremely cold temperatures is off ice or overflow and the water management needed to tackle those problems. In the photo here, you'll see a picture of a bridge over the Little Toke River on the Toke Cutoff. Our operators were able to go in and cut a new channel to reestablish flow under the bridge and prevent any damage to the bridge. But this happens on the Richardson, the Parks, the Dalton Highway, and it can vary from year to year based on weather, but typically happens during really cold temperatures when we see water bodies freeze all the way to the ground, pushing the water up over the top, and then we see the buildup of ice. So we've also next slide, please. I think it's on the next slide. Other challenges we've seen are in the Valdez area. This is in the Thompson Pass area. For those of you who remember the Damalanche, same area, less severe this time. But we saw 51 inches of snow and five inches of rain over just a couple days, which left Thompson Pass closed. We responded. You can see it took out some guardrail. There's still ice frozen in the road in this location. These events do have lasting impacts for us in the wintertime. Some additional stuff is we closed Trims Camp for an avalanche as well. Trims Camp is on the Richardson Highway, right in the middle of the Alaska Range. So we saw an avalanche there. We recently closed Trims Camp due to 50 mile an hour winds and snow drifting, whiteout conditions. That is another situation that we run into is drifting snow. That's next slide, please. Dalton Highway, we've had a number of closures this year. As the pictures show, some of the closures are caused by commercial vehicles. The Dalton Highway is a very remote road, and as such, there's very limited commercial support for response efforts. So that can lead to extended response times and road closures when we see commercial vehicles block both lanes of traffic. There's also limited communications, and so trying to get messages back to the public is a tall order. We're able to do that increasingly well with Starlink and other technologies, but it is still a limited communications up there. We've recently had two additional closures on the Dalton Highway related to weather. We saw significant blows come through north of the pass in the ice cut, which is around the 300 mile. We saw drifts up to 18 feet thick. It took us most of a day and a half to be able to cut back through that and open the road back up. And in those kind of blows too, when we take our equipment out, it actually blows hard enough and transports enough snow that it clogs the air filter on the equipment and can hamper our ability to respond until weather sets down. So the Dalton Highway is always an active and challenging environment, our crews are generally able to get it back open fairly shortly after the ends of events.
And for the record, Andy Mills, on this particular photo to your left, the tanker truck, what I find, again, just making sure you understand, when an incident like that happens, they have to bring another vehicle to the company and drain the tank before it can then be moved. So there's a lot of logistics involved in some of these clearing operations. So,
very good. I have a question, Mr. Adamczak, a curiosity. In Southwest states like New Mexico and others, they have significant road impacts from very large sand dunes that move incredibly quickly. I'm wondering, is there any ability to kind of work together with people in that situation to prevent – they have interesting ways they prevent dunes from moving and impacting the roadway. Could we do similar things with snowdrifts, do you think?
Yeah, I know that historically there has been snow fences placed on the Dalton. I haven't seen them in place in a while, but that's certainly something that could be looked into. I think that sometimes these snowdrifts can arrive or be present in different areas, but that's certainly something to look into is the locations and the prevalence of seeing them in the same locations.
Right on. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Andy Mills for the record. Senator Rauscher, aren't there snow fences along the Glen Highway in one of your districts, right? And those assist, of course, with keeping the drift off of the road. Just we have examples in the rest of the state.
There's one or two on the Richardson also. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Where they always close it. Yeah.
Okay. So, Mr. Chairman, we transition from Northern Region. Thank you, Mr. Adamczak, to South Coast Region with Mr. Zimmerman.
For the record, Marcus Zimmerman, South Coast Region. So, like Andy had mentioned earlier, and Dan had also mentioned, this is a snapshot on these slides from January timeframe. I do have a few updated numbers where I could get them. Looking current here, we have had a total of 217 events for South Coast Region, and our total target or our number of targets were 399. We have had 360 targets achieved for a 90% rating at this point in time. I do want to talk about some of the successes and some of the challenges we've had. When we put this slide deck together, it was back when we had had some significant storms in Southeast Alaska. Part of the, you know, we've missed some targets there. There was a lot of snow during that event. So a little bit smaller storms in some cases here throughout the rest of the region since then. So we've been able to increase our efficiency rates a little bit on those meeting those targets for our road conditions. We'll move on to the next slide here. For our, back in 2025, we did a little bit of contracting, not very much, as you can see on this slide, a little over $9,000. We started to look at the northern and central region models for South Coast region and have increased some of the contracting that we've done, primarily in Juneau for sidewalk maintenance and some snow hauling that is associated with different maintenance. As we talked, sidewalks get buried in snow and there's no other place to put it, so we have to haul it away. So year to date, the slide was for 1231 for the 28th of February. We are now at $236,985 spent in contracting for sidewalk snow removal and hauling of snow here in Juneau. $98,000 for the snow removal contract with sidewalks and $138,000 with the hauling contract.
Senator Tobin has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm curious, just with the relationship with the legislature, we have a lot of folks who fly in. Oftentimes there are community groups that are in accessible devices and that need to traverse the bottom of the hill to the top of the hill in which we have the legislative offices. Is there a relationship with resources that come from the legislature or from the state government to ensure that constituents can access their capital if they are able to get into Juneau and come to visit lawmakers?
Through the chair, Senator Tobin, Department of Transportation does our best to keep the sidewalks maintained so everybody has access. I feel that this year we have done a much better job in that. From the bottom of the hill to the Capitol building is the city and borough of Juneau's responsibility for those sidewalks. But the ones that the state maintains through contracting, I think that we've been able to deliver better service to those sidewalks that we have.
Mr. Mills.
Thank you, Andy Mills, for the record. Just with a caveat, of course, that around some of the state buildings, we certainly have DFS, our facility services folks, that clear the sidewalks. And I've seen them at all hours getting out there and clearing those and putting salt down to make sure that those are safe surfaces. So,
Senator Rauscher.
So, yeah, thank you to the chair. So I've noticed that skid steers with snowblowers on them and some of your giant brushes have been utilized a lot more lately. And so I imagine that that's part of your fleet now, which is why we've had a better record, maybe.
Through the chairman, Senator Rauscher, we utilize all pieces of equipment that we have available to us to do the job required during the given event. Sometimes that is skid steers with snow blowers or brushes. Sometimes it's plow trucks. It just depends on the amount of snow. It depends on what the event gives us. But we use everything that we have available to us to maintain and clear the snow and ice.
Please continue.
Again, for the record, Marcus Zimmerman. So this was a particularly challenging event on Alaska. This happened at the end of December. We had high winds, heavy rains. It was at the beginning of the cod fishery, which is the one of the biggest fisheries out there in Dutch Harbor or in the Bering Sea. Winds hit plus 120 miles an hour. One of the things that happened during this event was the direction of the wind picked up rocks and debris and threw them onto the runway, closing the runway for 3 days. We lost light cans, which are what the runway lights are attached to. It actually pulled those out of the ground in at the end of the runway, and it deposited rocks onto the runway. Our state maintenance forces that were there were able to clear the runway after it was safe to do so when the winds slowed down, and we were able to get an emergency contractor on board to repair the lighting system that had failed at that point in time. The runway was down for 72 hours, closed for 72 hours during that period, and we were doing everything we could to get it reopened because there were lots of people waiting on getting in and out of Dutch Harbor for that fishery that was starting up, cannery workers, fishermen, and such.
Very good. Thank you.
This slide shows the record-setting snows here in Juneau. I was trying to get an update from National Weather Service this morning to see where we were for the yearly total so far, but I was not able to get that. But back in December, we had 3 record-setting days for snow. The snowfall was a total of 47.7 inches, and we set a new monthly record for December at 80.7 inches. Significant snowfall. The graph shows the highest, which was back in 75, 76, this winter, and then what our normal and what our average is. We have definitely received more snow since then. February was a little bit of a break, which was good for us. We needed that. But we did have another record-setting day here last week.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Tobin.
May I ask what it is for January?
I'd have to get back with you, Senator Tobin, through chair. I'd have to get back to you on that. I don't have that information for January's snow.
I'll be able to find it over here.
Well, I'm very curious because I anticipate we've beaten this December record.
So, Marcus Zimmerman, again, for the record. We had not only here in Juneau record-setting events, Skagway and Haines also had some pretty extreme weather over that time period. At that time, the Klondike Highway had been closed. We had 287 hours of closure from the beginning of the winter to the date here in early January. And 43 hours of closure time on the Haines Highway due to blizzards, extreme cold, and avalanches. We did bring staff down from Northern Region. We were able to share some staffing resources to help support in Skagway. We were able to bring some folks up from Ketchikan to help support in Haines during this event. We also had some contractors on board in Haines as well during this event. Our current closure times so far this winter on the Klondike Highway are up to 330 hours now.
Oh, Senator Rush has a question.
Yeah, through the chair. So is that typical? Is that like a typical one over there?
Through the chair, Senator Rauscher. It's a little bit higher than normal for even like Klondike Highway. Haines, we don't usually see that many hours of closure on the Haines Highway due to snow events. So that's a little bit up there too. But around 330 hours is getting pretty high for even Klondike Highway, which gets a lot of heavy snow, a lot of drifting, avalanche concerns on the Klondike Highway. I don't have a number for what average would be, but 330 is getting pretty high for us at this point in time.
All right, thanks.
I also have a question. Do you expect winter events like this to increase potential for rockfall on the Haines Highway?
To the chairman, it's possible because of the freeze thaw cycle that might happen here this spring. It's an unknown, but it's a possibility.
Okay. Thank you.
So with the December, early January storms, the governor did declare a state disaster declaration. So part of that was bringing through the Emergency Operations Center. We brought Division of Facility Services folks down to help the city and borough of Juneau clear some of their critical infrastructure. I think that was primarily school roofs here in town. We also supported with using LIDAR and our drone program. So LIDAR is light detecting ranging to help with the avalanche detection for Mount Juneau to help support the city in their needs there. For the South Coast Avalanche Program, we did have our first successful avalanche detection using infrasound technology. My avalanche specialist called me and he was very excited that he was able to hear an avalanche actually happening and not see it. It was dark, and he was able to see that there was something moving on the mountain before, without actually having visual on it, through that. We've also looked at, we did use LIDAR on other snowpacks around the, district up in Haines as well, because we did have avalanche cycles on the Haines Highway, which is not something that has been a historic event where we have had impacts to the highway like we did this winter. We also used drones to monitor our hazards as well down on Thane Road. Yesterday, we actually did some drone flights using explosives to do mitigation on the Thane Road corridor yesterday. And this is my last slide, and it shows the picture there shows what infrasound is seeing. So it's listening to the snowpack, and each of those little dots is movement of snow down the mountainside. So you can actually see this is what the avalanche specialist was so excited about, being able to see that there was something happening and know that the road closure was warranted and that we were protecting the traveling public because of that. So Thane Road at this point in time had been closed for 93 hours. Currently, as of yesterday's closure, we're at 167 hours of closure time for Thane Road here in Juneau.
So, for the record, Andy Mills. So, Mr. Chairman, as we transition to the last few slides, DMIO, the Data Modernization and Innovation Office Director, Christine Langley, who I believe is still on the phone, or Teams, would be able to address these last few slides. She did have some front-loaded slides in this presentation with me, and these last couple are for her. So if we can.
Most excellent. Ms. Langley, welcome to Senate Transportation.
Thank you. For the record, Christine Langley, Data Modernization and Innovation Director for the Department of Transportation. The first slide here, as you've heard from our other folks, was dated. This is the 2025 calendar year impacts of avalanches, and while it's quite significant, we have moved on since then. And so starting after this one, so January 1 through today, we've seen another 192 avalanches that have been reported, 22 that have had an impact on the road, and we've had to close the road for a total of 546 hours. Many of those hours are the ones that Mr. Marcus mentioned. And so avalanches have a significant impact on our transportation system, and we're working hard to come up with various ways that we can mitigate them. Not every avalanche is the same, not every avalanche path or area in the state is the same. And so we need a suite of tools to help us not only mitigate them when they happen, predict them before they happen, and then subsequently keep the transportation system open. Next slide, please.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to highlight some of the names that I see on this particular slide. And are these actual names of places or are these names of avalanches?
Through the chair, Senator Tobin, these are names of avalanche zones that are around the state. And of course, the names that appear and kind of are related to how far you zoom in. And so we do name avalanche areas around the state, and these ones represent that.
Well, thank you. I was very curious about Tracy's trickle.
Agreed.
Next slide.
For the record, Christine Langley. One of the ways that we are working to handle avalanches there along the Seward Highway was just installed in the last month. This is a Doppler radar, so this effectively is a unit that needs to see the avalanche path. And when it sees that avalanche path and any movement in that area, it can trigger an automated notification that goes out to staff. And we're working to verify the accuracy of this device right now, because we do anticipate being able to put up visible signals to the traveling public. And so not only will that message come in, as Marcus mentioned, to one of our staff and, you know, potentially the middle of the night, but if someone can't get there right away, there'll be lights that indicate to the traveling public that something has occurred and they should use caution or stop altogether. And we're excited to bring this automated system to Alaska. We have a lot of miles to cover. Next slide.
I'll pause for one moment just to Andy Mills for the record. So Chair Bjorkman, one of your staff was transiting down the Haines Highway, and I knew they were traveling at the exact time that we got an alert that there was an avalanche on that highway. And I was concerned. So we called, and fortunately your staff was enjoying a cold beverage in Haines when I contacted them. However, without this type of technology, that's the concern. You don't know if someone is in one of those or not. So anything we can do in these remote locations to ensure safety and awareness is, we'll keep those phone calls from having sort of the wrong outcome. So
absolutely. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Director Langley, go ahead.
For the record, Christine Langley, this next unit is, instead of visual line of sight, it operates off of sound. And so the one that Mr. Zimmerman had mentioned that went in a couple years ago, that was part of our research program, which Mr. Mills mentioned earlier. That was an instance where we knew or had heard of a technology that probably would work well for the state of Alaska. And so we used research funds to install it, and then we're able to monitor its productivity. And subsequently, we actually got to hear an avalanche go off ahead of time. We have installed another unit now that we are confident in its success. We've installed another unit along the Seward Highway, and that went in a couple months ago as well. This system work will require us to dial it in a little bit more, because sound travels in various ways depending on the terrain in the area, but it too will be able to alert us, and subsequently we'll reach a point where we can use it to alert the track. Next slide.
Good stuff.
We've had a busy first couple months, so this too happened first part of 2026. And so this is the mobile boomwhush, and the very technical description that some of our staff use is the giant potato gun. This is a unit that is portable and can be moved from place to place. This helps us address smaller avalanches that are on areas right next to the side of the highway. We can drive this to the location, back it up. It can fire every 20 seconds, which allows us to get a lot of work done in a hurry and bring in our MNO staff to clear it out after that. It is done with a mixture of oxygen and propane. This is a technology that's going to help us reduce some of our dependency on the howitzers that we use today and allow us to mitigate faster and proactively.
Very good. Can you help us understand how this contraption works?
You can think of it as a massive air blast. I'm sorry, through the Chair Berkman. You can think of it as a massive air blast. So propane and oxygen are mixed together. They are lit effectively, and you've got an enormous blast of air that comes out of the unit, hits the side of that hillside or that collection of snow. It causes that snow to become unstable. It shifts rapidly and drops down. And then MNO is able to come in and clear that area out, and we can drive that unit back to the MNO station that it's closest to.
That's amazing. I would imagine you could probably load a pumpkin or a cabbage or a watermelon in one of these, eh?
Chair Bjornman, that sounds like our next research project. Yes.
I like it.
So this is, these are three new technologies that we put in place just this year, or subsequently put in additional areas this year. And you'll see on that next slide, it takes a whole suite of items. So we use howitzers, we use drones, we use radar, we now are using infrasound, and all of these together are moving us towards a place where we can reduce the impacts of the avalanches on the roadway, keep our uptime as much as possible, and make sure that the traveling public is safe as we can. As we can happen.
So, Andy Mills, for the record, Mr. Chairman, we skipped ahead in our last presentation to the SCF slides. However, I understand from your very capable aide that Mr. Bilsma is on the line. Last time, Christy Futrell was on the line, his deputy, and she was addressing these slides. But if Mr. Bilsma is still on the line and you have any other questions on this or would like to entertain anything else, I believe that's a resource available.
Thank you, Mr. Mills. Mr. Bilsma, I'm wondering if you could just chat with us a little bit about the financial needs of the equipment fleet. How are we doing? How do we feel about how the fleet is holding up this winter? And what do we need to be looking at as far as maintenance and reinvestment to make sure we're ready and nimble for years to come?
Thank you, Chair Bjorkman. For the record, Brad Bilsma, Department of Transportation State Equipment Fleet Manager. Financially, for replacement of fleet, as far as we are doing, we're about on schedule with the funding that we have. I don't really have maybe a lot of specifics to add to what was given to you before. We do have we're replacing as many plow trucks as we can order to reduce the service life of those trucks. We found that they work much better at a 10 to 12 year life as opposed to a 12 to 15 year life. And so that's been a focus for the last year or two, is to try and focus on replacing our snow plow trucks, which is the kind of the flagship of our snow fighting fleet.
Okay. Thank you for that. I appreciate that. Senator Rauscher has a question, and then I'll have a couple more.
So, real quick, when you look at this bottom half of this slide, equipment notes, we're talking statewide. Is that correct? And not just the northern fleet anymore.
Through the chair, Senator Rauscher, yes, this would be statewide. We've added a couple of different variations of snow blowers on skid steers and in our mower tractors that we use in the summertime to mow medians and ditches, so that we're able to use those to clear sidewalks in the wintertime. And yes, that would apply statewide, not just the northern region.
You bet.
Again, for the record, Andy Mills. Yeah, Mr. Chairman, we covered these slides, it was to see if you had any additional questions. I can advance to the end if you'd like.
Yep. Nope. I was just taking it all in. As we look at equipment available to our O&M folks, recently I visited the community of Moose Pass, and they are very passionate about the road, and they have to travel quite a bit from Moose Pass, both south to Seward and north to Anchorage, and then maybe west towards Soldotna on the Sterling. But it was apparent talking to folks over there that they felt that they did not have all of the tools and manpower needed to deal with some pretty significant water on the road. When it comes to even having enough signs to put out to warn people that there's the road has been kind of encroached on by a lake, pretty much. So is there a way, like, do we have good processes in place to kind of expedite resources where we need them when we have pretty significant events, so that we can get ditches, culverts de-iced to de-water spots? How do we deal with things like that?
Chair Bjorkman, that is usually the domain of the maintenance and operations superintendents and chiefs. I will say, speaking specifically to the Peninsula District, but it's really true statewide, the ability to move equipment, we share and move equipment and surge equipment to the need, so to speak, or to the location in need. So quite frequently, there's frequent examples. Recently, Juneau area or southeast area, an extensive amount of snow, moved a snowblower from northern region from the Fairbanks area, trucked it to Haines, used it in Haines and Skagway and in the Juneau area. Similar scenario last year when there was a significant snowfall and landslide, ended up with a very large boulder on the Parks Highway in northern region, and we moved snowblowers and loaders and other equipment north from central region to take care of that. The M&O chiefs and superintendents all have that leeway to do that. And we do keep a small fleet of what we call our daily pool equipment that is not necessarily assigned to any one particular user, that is available to really all users. So even outside of DOT, so if Department of Natural Resources needed a grader or a bulldozer, we have it's a small pool, but there is a pool of equipment that is not necessarily assigned to any one particular user that we can move fairly quickly as well.
That's interesting. Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Senator Rauscher.
So since we're at the end here, my understanding is that the material compound that we use to make up asphalt is not the same as it used to be 20 years ago. It's because it's supposed to be quieter, or whatever reason that I've been told. Is there any truth to that? And I guess what I'm trying to get at is studded tires. I see where roads wearing out a lot, I guess more often and a lot easier. So is there any truth to what I started with? And is there any reason that they may not be as durable when it comes to studded tires? And so are we defeating, and if all of what I said is true, are we defeating our purpose in that regard?
For the record, Andy Mills, through the chair to Senator Rauscher, you enter a tricky territory when we talk about studded tires in Alaskans. We have entertained, I know I have had staff who have suggested the infrastructure impacts of having studded tires for even 1 week more or less, and what that overall does to the infrastructure. There's a safety issue in making sure you don't cut that too tight, and that you allow people to retain studded tires. They've talked about the alternative of, apparently, I've never seen these, but the plastic, it's instead of metal, they use a different substance for the studded. I personally use all weather instead of that, but it's a difficult area to get into, and I think it's one that would be fraught with a lot of community input that says that if where there was any sort of impact or restriction on studded tires, that you would definitely hear from a concerted effort from communities that's sacrosanct to them. But the answer to your question is, first of all, asphalt and its composition has changed over the years, because I've heard former Commissioner McKinnon talk about, we don't pave roads like we used to. And it was about the content, not just the process. And then as far as impact of studded tires, I certainly anecdotally feel like in my youth, I saw less studded tires past the period they were supposed to. And I think that's an enforcement issue, as a number of other things are enforcement related, as for studded tires on well after they're supposed to be taken off. And so there's a confluence of a lot of different conversations on this one topic.
Senator?
I'm just going to, we'll talk more some other time on the topic. Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman, I'll hearken back to our first. We are going to have a pavement presentation where this would fit nicely.
Yes.
Then I'll save those questions.
Thank yes. You. No, I would like to have this conversation more when we talk about pavement. We can talk about polymerization. We can talk about sourcing of that. There's a long history of that. And I'll save the stories for later, some other time, I think.
I appreciate this. Thank you.
You bet. I think that's all I have for today. So mercifully, I've probably forgot my other questions, and that's okay for now. So anything further? Well, thank you all for being here and for completing this presentation. Once again, thank you to Ms. Hannah Leatherman from Seward High School, winner of the Caring for the Kenai contest, and her presentation on graphene nanoplatelets as being a part of an asphalt mix to help prevent our roads from icing and needing to use less brine or hopefully none. We will continue that conversation more in the future, and it's exciting that she may be able to get some additional research done through the Department of Transportation on her idea of graphene nanoplatelets. That concludes our business for today here in Senate Transportation. The Senate Transportation Committee will meet again next Thursday, March 19th, when we will hear an update on the Alaska Marine Highway System. We will not meet on Tuesday of next week. With that, we are adjourned at 2:54 p.m.